the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Charleston, South Carolina. It is a spectacular January day here. The sun is out, and Charleston is a city of so many charms, but it is also a city of churches, and I am here to participate in a conference at the Episcopal Cathedral here in South Carolina. And the conference is entitled Mere Anglicanism. We're going to be talking about that in just a few moments with a very special guest. In the meantime, we're going to be looking at some issues in the news. Big news, of course, as the entire nation is focused on the inauguration of the nation's 44th president, Barack Obama. The president-elect and his transition committee, along with the official inaugural committee, are continuing to release information related to official events, even as we are practically there. Tonight, of course, President George W. Bush, the 43rd President of the United States, delivers his farewell address to the nation. But most of the controversy, interestingly enough, heading into this particular inauguration has to do with prayer. And it has to do with the kind of representational prayer that has become a part of America's civil religion. In particular, as we were headed into Christmas and the New Year, there was a great deal of controversy about the Obama administration or transition committee's choice of a Saddleback pastor Rick Warren to deliver the invocation at the formal January 20th inauguration and its ceremony. Of course, Rick Warren, a pastor there of one of the nation's largest evangelical megachurches, had been a very, very clear proponent of Proposition 8 in California, the measure that passed on November the 4th, which modified the California Constitution to establish marriage as and only as the union of a man and a woman. Homosexual activists and others on the left really responded with an entire cavalcade of outrage at the choice of Rick Warren. Shortly thereafter, there were assurances from the transition committee and from the president-elect that his approach would indeed reflect to what he calls diversity and the diversity of the nation. The announcement that came just a few years ago that Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson, the first openly homosexual bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, would be opening the big event, which is largely an entertainment event there at the Lincoln Memorial just in days before, as the weekend starts, headed towards the Tuesday inauguration. This led to another round of controversy, and it had to do not only with the fact that Bishop Robinson was chosen, but had a great deal to do with what Bishop Robinson had to say. I wrote an article about that is still posted, the top article at my website at albertmohler.com. Bishop Robinson made some most unusual remarks to the New York Times, especially his remark that he was adamant that his prayer would not be a Christian prayer. He said he'd been looking at recent inaugural prayers and was, and this is his word, horrified at how, quote, specifically and aggressively Christian they were. I am very clear, he said, this will not be a Christian prayer, and I won't be quoting scripture or anything like that. The texts that I hold as sacred are not sacred texts for all Americans, and I want all people to feel that this is their prayer. Bishop Robinson said he might address the nation to, quote, might address the prayer, that is, to, quote, the God of our many understandings, end quote, language that he said he had picked up in a 12-step recovery program for his alcohol addiction. Now, I dealt with this on the program earlier this week. That's a very interesting statement. I'm actually thankful for it because it discloses so much of what is really going on in the crisis in American Christianity. Bishop Robinson is not a Christian bishop. I mean, he's very clear that his role, as he sees it, is something other than as a minister of the gospel, and that comes out in his public pronouncements here. You have two very different men here with Rick Warren and with Bishop Robinson. And as I suggested, the media keeps talking about them as two very different representatives of one religion. But I'm with Gresham Machen on this one. They are actually two very, very indicative representatives of two very different religions when you actually get to what the two men believe. Now, I'm a bit perplexed, I have to tell you, what came to me yesterday. And that was the remark by Rick Warren, a statement released to Christianity Today, in which he affirmed the choice of Gene Robinson to deliver that prayer and spoke of it as a part of the new incoming Obama administration's commitment to represent all people. I just have to tell you, I cannot join in that celebration because my first and foremost citizenship, according to the Apostle Paul, is not an earthly citizenship. And I am not able to celebrate in any sense whatsoever the participation of someone in such a symbolic role who represents such a repudiation of biblical Christianity. I can celebrate religious liberty, and I do. And that's a part of Baptist identity, is celebrating religious liberty, which allows persons to believe as they would believe, to teach and to preach as they would teach or preach. But I can't celebrate this. I can agree that religious liberty can produce this, and it's fully legal, no doubt about that. But I can't celebrate it. And similarly, we have also now news that has just come out about Barack administration's choice of clergy now, including a Muslim woman and rabbis will be praying at different events related to the inauguration. Now, before you get to any of the controversy about any of these persons, just recognize that this is a demonstration of civil religion. And as I said on this program many times, the one thing worse than a nation that is marked by civil religion is a nation that is not. There's something very important about this nation in its formal ceremonies coming to the point where it admits that it is not transcendent and it is not ultimate. We are, after all, talking about the inauguration of a president of the United States, not a creator or a redeemer. We're here talking about the acknowledgement, just as you have on the nation's currency, In God We Trust, just as, of course, tradition has concluded the oath of office with the words, So help me God. It is a very important affirmation of the ultimacy of one who stands over the government. But I'm really intrigued by a statement I saw late last night as I was reviewing some of the controversies here, and it was a statement that came from someone on the far, far left, and as is so often the case, you find yourself in agreement with something and someone unexpectedly. But a gay rights activist, a lesbian from California, was making a very interesting point. She said, maybe this controversy leads us to understand that no one can be the nation's pastor. I found that a very revealing statement. Of course, you have the media having talked about Billy Graham being the nation's pastor, and then some have dubbed Rick Warren the new nation's pastor, but we're now hearing from many people in this country who say Rick Warren is not their pastor. And my point is simply this. When you are looking at a nation as diverse as the United States of America, as an evangelical-believing Christian, you have to see this nation as a mission field. And that's why, for instance, at meetings such as the ones I'm attending here, I am so thrilled to be, for instance, with Christians from Africa in order to say to them, send your missionaries. William Bennett said this some years ago. He said, the United States is becoming the kind of nation people used to send missionaries to. And that's exactly the case. And, of course, it's actually always been that way because there are always persons in need of the gospel. But it is particularly, perhaps, that way as we look to it now. U.S. Airways is reporting a crash of a jet aircraft in the Hudson River shortly upon takeoff from New York's LaGuardia Airport. The good news here is that it appears there are no fatalities. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was the announcement in the paper that American Airlines, that is all of the airlines in America, had passed a 2-year mark with no fatalities. And it looks like even with this untoward event, and it had to be horrifying for those who were on that jet, it has ended with injury to the jet, but not to the persons who were therein. And that's something for which we should certainly be very, very thankful. Looking at other issues in the news, one of the things that, of course, we're going to be watching for in coming days is what happens with the exercise of executive powers. The President of the United States, in any incoming administration, has the opportunity through the regulative and bureaucratic functions of government to exercise extraordinary authority through issuing executive orders. President George W. Bush, when he entered office in January of 2001, released a flurry of executive orders, and some of them are ones of incredible significance to those who care, for instance, for the sanctity of human life, reversing several policies that have been in place from the outgoing Clinton administration. Then, just days before the September 11, 2001 attacks, the major controversy in America was over an executive order released by the president in August of 2001 on the use of human embryos in stem cell experimentation. Of course, the president, this case President George W. Bush, limited the use of federal funds for experimentation that would destroy human embryos to the existing stem cell lines, thus in an effort to protect the dignity and sanctity of every single human life, even at the stage of its embryonic development. There is now an assurance coming. The New York Times is out with a story, Charlie Savage reporting what we already have known, but with some very interesting detail, that the incoming administration and allies in Congress are working to see how quickly many of these executive orders in place for the last 8 years can be reversed, changed, or modified. One interesting thing to watch, and this is something that a lot of Americans have probably missed, when President Clinton came into office in 1993, his first controversy, among many subsequent controversies, was over the policy known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, dealing with homosexuals in the military. There are many who believe that President Obama, incoming, the president-elect, once he is inaugurated, would be able to reverse that. But since that was later ratified by Congress, that is actually now a matter of legislation. But the incoming administration signaled yesterday that it intends to move as quickly as possible to reverse that policy. In an amazing response, and this is truly amazing, of political brevity, when asked by a reporter if that would be one of the first actions of the administration, the answer was simply, yes. We'll be back to talk about mere Anglicanism and what that says about mere Christianity when we come back on the Albert Mueller Program. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world, this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and we'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Anyone with the knowledge of church history knows that there have been several decisive turning points in the history of the church. And when you look through over 20 centuries of church history, there are many decisive turning points. There are many periods in which you would have had to have thought that the persons active and engaged in the issues at the time would have understood the importance of what was going on. I really believe in 325, those who would have been gathered in that Asia Minor city of Nicaea for the first ecumenical council of the church, where Arianism was being discussed, and where you had the contest between Arius and Athanasius over the true nature of Christ. That would have had to have been a time when virtually everyone there, of course, having the Roman emperor there to convene the meeting, probably underlined its importance. If you were Luther at the Diet of Worms, if so many places where you could have been, where you would have known that the church is at one of these crucial turning points in history. I have to tell you that I believe the times in which we are living are similarly eventful. We're looking at a reshaping of Christianity in our times. We're also looking at something that's very counterintuitive. And the very counterintuitive character of this tells us that we ought to be paying particularly attention. Intelligent Christians ought to be asking questions. What does it mean that here in the 21st century, Americans are looking to Africa for theological assistance? There's something marvelously gracious about that in the providence of God. I'm here for a conference known as Mere Anglicanism. It's held at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke and St. Paul. It is a conference following on the heels of another, so I'm very glad to be here in the presence of evangelical Anglicans and Episcopalians dealing with some of the issues, not only facing their church, but in all honesty, facing us all. The Episcopal Church USA has been in the headlines, and for good reason. For most of the last several years, it has been embroiled in controversy and very recent developments, including the development of a new Anglican church in North America. Other developments, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of talk about this here. But I'm very glad to have you here in the studio with me in Charleston, a very special guest. The Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon is the rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Fort Worth, Texas. Pastor, it's good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
Now, tell me, exactly what do you hope is going to take place here at this conference?
My hopes are that bringing in these experts who will provide helpful analysis of, you know, what kind of circumstances got us in this mess, it might help us see, well, how do we proceed through it? How do we move beyond it? How do we really live into what I think is like a second reformation?
A second reformation, you know, when you're looking at what is going on in American Christianity, the need for that kind of reformation is abundant. The evidence continues to mount, not only in, of course, the Episcopal Church, but in the other mainline Protestant denominations, but also in reports such as what have been coming out, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, its giant U.S. religious landscape study, now a report coming out this week from the Barna Research Group. Americans who call themselves evangelical are apparently decreasingly so in terms of what they actually know and believe.
Right. Yes, I've seen that.
Now, you're a pastor in Fort Worth. How do you envision this, first of all, as a challenge as a pastor?
Well, it's a challenge because we have changed our provincial connection. We previously were in part, we were part of TEC, the Episcopal Church, and we have left TEC and become part of the Southern Cone. We will shortly move into the new province. So the people have to be assured that this movement is okay, that it's justified, and it's in fact helpful. So there's a lot of explaining, a lot of education, but it's a good time. It's a very good time for us. People are excited about it.
I want to follow this through with you, if I might, because I think this becomes something that can be encouraging to many others. You lead a church that was in what you call the TEC, that's the Episcopal Church, ECUSA is how many people in the media refer to it, Episcopal Church USA. You felt that you had to make a change. Now, that could not just be an easy thing for a church.
Well, actually, the church independently or alone did not make it. The whole diocese made this decision, the entire diocese.
That makes it even more remarkable.
It is very remarkable. We have a very bold and remarkable bishop, Bishop Jack Eicher, and we have a very unified diocese, and an overwhelming preponderance of the delegates voted, more than 80% voted to leave TEC and to attach to the Southern Cone. So it's historic.
But it's so historic, I think it's amazing. Most Americans, including most even evangelical Christians, are generally unaware of this in terms of what it actually means. So you have the diocese there in Fort Worth, and in mass, basically, it left the denomination, which had been apart virtually since the Revolutionary War, and has identified with the larger Anglican Communion. But in particular, you sought oversight from a bishop in a very different continent.
That's true. But the Southern Cone is dynamic. It's evangelical. It's
And define that for people so they know what that is.
The Southern Cone is, we have 38 provinces in global Anglicanism. One of them in South America is called the Southern Cone. And we have attached to that group, and they're dynamic and growing and evangelical, and we fit there perfectly. Whereas
this would be Argentina and
yes,
Peru.
Yes.
Yes, and nations such as that. Well, that's remarkable. And again, when you start looking at the age of missionary expansion, I'm thinking of Philip Schaff's History of the Expansion to Christianity, you know, the great Yale professor looking back, and he spoke about how, you know, Christianity was first of all an ancient Near Eastern, you know, faith as it began there in Jerusalem. And, of course, just following the logic of the Great Commission, it spread. And, of course, it became identified with Europe and what has historically been identified as Christendom. And then through the expansion of European influence, not to mention the colonization of the United States, and through such things as the development of the British Empire, and the missionary efforts of churches in the United States and in Europe, these nations were reached by persons who took the gospel. And of course, in much of South America, you had you know, different things, the Catholic Church sending. So you could see as Spain was also building its empire. But now you're looking at your church looking literally to what had been the target of nation, the focus nation of missionary concern, and asking for help. You have in the Anglican Communion one of the most incredible witnesses, I think, to the power of the gospel, where you have archbishops like Archbishop Orimbi and others from Africa who are offering such courageous leadership. And then you have the incredible picture, which I saw just in a juxtaposition in recent days, of Catherine Jefferts Schori, the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, over against one of these African bishops. And it was just, to me, as if one had abandoned the gospel as the other had embraced it. You have to see this as a remarkable thing.
It is remarkable, and the disparity between the two views of reality is almost absolute.
Now, that's another interesting statement. You know, play that out just a little bit. When it's almost absolute, you mean it's not over just the issue of homosexuality, for instance?
Oh, absolutely not. That's merely the fruit of the tree. That's merely symptomatic of an underlying malaise, disease. It's about biblical authority. It's about who do we believe? Who speaks with authority? And it goes way on back to the 60s, I think, in the Episcopal Church, when Pike doubted the Trinity and was never disciplined. Once you jettison biblical authority, it all goes out the window, and that's what happened with us.
Well, and that will happen anywhere. It could happen just as easily in Methodism or Lutheranism or among Baptists. Once biblical authority is surrendered, then ultimately all is lost. And the Southern Baptist Convention had to go through incredible years of controversy dealing with the same issue. You know, I such close friends in the Presbyterian Church USA, the PCA, they had to withdraw from the Presbyterian denomination. You have some hopeful things happening in many of these large denominations, but by and large, we are facing a complete realignment. We're at the point now where what Gresham Machen, I've mentioned him before, but I just think of him so often with this. He wrote a book entitled Christianity and Liberalism early in the 20th century, and he made the point that denominational lines still remain important because we believe that truth is indeed important, but we stand united in the gospel. And as he said, you know, a conservative in one denomination has far more in common with a conservative in another denomination than either of those two individuals would have with the liberals who have departed the faith but want to keep the labels. Let me invite you to join the conversation. We'd love to hear what you're thinking. Perhaps you have a question for Pastor Dixon, the Right Reverend, that is the Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon, rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm Albert Miller. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We are here at the Mere Anglicanism Conference, which is being held at the Cathedral Church of St. Luke and St. Paul here in Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston is a very evangelical diocese of the Episcopal Church, and there are folks here gathered from all over the world. However, I'm looking at the schedule of persons to speak. Tomorrow morning, Bishop Michael Nazir Ali, Defender of the Faith, Bishop of the Church of England, will be here. African archbishops, including Archbishop Valentino Mokiwa and also Archbishop Benjamin Kwashi. There you're looking at two very well-known defenders of the faith. Again, meeting here. The title may throw some people off, and my guest today is going to help explain that to us. The Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon is the rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Fort Worth, Texas. When you think of the word mere, it can be misleading. I'm sure this harkens back to C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, and by that he didn't mean how to make Christianity small. He meant how to get to the essence of the thing.
That's precisely what we mean. We're trying to get to the essence of Anglicanism. We're trying to look beyond the peculiarities of churchmanship that divide us a little bit and to think what's really foundational to who we are and what we believe.
Well, and evidently you were willing to have a Baptist here because I get to give the keynote address tonight, and I'm very, very honored to be here. I've actually been looking forward to this for a long time because I wanted to meet so many people who are on this conference platform. I've spoken to many of them by phone and on this program and in other contexts, but it is a high privilege to be here. If you're going to define mere Anglicanism, how would you do that?
I would say mere Anglicanism is that expression of Reformed Catholic Christianity that's ancient. It goes right back to the second century. And it's reached globally, it reaches across the whole world, and it's anchored to a confidence in the primacy of the Scriptures, the authority of the Scriptures. And its most definitive expression is the 39 Articles of Religion.
And, of course, I would also have to say as a non-Anglican that a part of our indebtedness, for instance, to the Church of England is for the Book of Common Prayer.
Oh, absolutely.
And there you're looking, you know, there are millions of American Christians, including many who wouldn't know what a prayer book is, who nonetheless have been nurtured in Christianity by the language of the Book of Common Prayer. There are millions of people who are married in Baptist and Presbyterian churches and others who are married with the language of the Book of Common Prayer, going all the way back, of course, to Archbishop Cranmer and the 16th century. But when you start thinking about mere Anglicanism, because only a minority of those listening to the program right now will be Anglicans. Just to get to the essence of how this ties to the larger Christian world, when you're thinking about mere Anglicanism, a lot of people are going to say, why do you have to talk about that now? How could there be so much confusion about what that is to mean? Which is to say, in other words, what happened to the Episcopal Church?
I think what happened was in the 60s, we had some crazy bishops that decided they didn't believe anything and thought they could assert that with impunity, and in fact did assert those disbeliefs with impunity. They were not disciplined. I'm talking about Bishop Pike, who doubted the Trinity. And since that time, we've shown ourselves unwilling or unable to discipline those that completely abandon the historic Christian faith. So this has thrown the whole Anglican communion into chaos, and the communion is now reasserting itself in saying what Anglicanism should mean, what it has always meant, and calling it back to its roots, to its historic roots.
Clive James, a very influential British man of letters, wrote in his book The Dreaming Swimmer, something I quoted in my article posted yesterday. The crisis in the Church of England, he wrote, is that too many of its bishops, and some would say of its archbishops, don't quite realize that they are atheists but have begun to suspect it. We all have to kind of laugh at that because of the irony in it, but it's really painful to think about. And, of course, we could expand that to say there are many pastors and many Protestant churches that are basically atheists, and they haven't figured that out yet.
Sadly, that's true. And one of our famous bishops, Spong, expressly denied the existence of God. So he's not being secretive about it.
No, and that's the amazing thing to see kind of what's going on. That's a very interesting point you raised, by the way, because in the Episcopal Church, heresy has been on the open, and you date it right, I think, to the 60s, Bishop James Pike, and since then so many others. Certainly, I have actually expressed some irony in observing John Shelby Spong, the now retired Episcopal Bishop of Newark, New Jersey. The irony is this. He's run out of things to deny. In the heresy industry, you only get headlines when you find something to deny, some doctrine to undermine and to reject. Well, he's gone so far as to reject a personal God, so his catalog is now empty. The only way you can get headlines now is to convert to biblical Christianity, which is something, by the way, we should pray to see what happened. But barring that, there's really very little new the man could possibly have to say. When we come back, we're going to talk about why, here in a new millennium, at the beginning of the 21st century, we're seeing some real signs of hope in and from some very unexpected places. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program live today from Charleston, South Carolina, and we'll be right back with you.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. You know, one of the things to watch in church history is devolution, decline, declension, whatever word you want to use. You could use harsher words such as abdication, treason. The Apostle Paul minces no words in describing those who would corrupt Christian doctrine. It's interesting that so many churches and denominations clearly and unapologetically established upon the gospel and biblical truth and biblical authority stray. And recurringly, in a world marked by sin, recurringly this happens, and we see a need for the church to be cleansed, to be brought back. My guest today has used the word that I think is the best of all, and that is the word reformation. The Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon is the rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Fort Worth, Texas, and we've been talking about the conference where we are mutually attending, and I'm speaking tonight here at Mere Anglicanism, meeting today, the special broadcast, by the way, coming to you from Charleston, South Carolina. Pastor Dixon, I'm holding here in my hand a reprint of the first English prayer book, which was compiled by Thomas Cranmer in 1549. And, of course, later developments in the Church of England led to the Book of Common Prayer and so many other things. But what amazes me when I look at this is how thoroughly saturated it is in Orthodox biblical Christianity.
It is but a pastiche of biblical reference from beginning to end, every bit of it.
But done so, by the way, with the most beautiful anglicized expressions. Here, this is the English language as it once was. The same kind of language that, of course, is replicated in the most influential translation of the Bible into English, the Authorized Version of 1611. But when you look at this, what amazes me, and this is something that is actually parallel in other denominations to Anglicanism, but you have a prayer book. Your officiating ministers read out of a prayer book.
Yes.
You know, in the Baptist world, that's not going to be the case. Instead, they're going to read from the Bible. But the problem is going to be the same. There are people who read these words who don't believe them. I just don't know how you could do that. And you represent a pastor who has led your people into the gospel and into an understanding of the riches of the Word of God and into trusting and believing and affirming the full authority of the Word of God. But I'm just trying to, with you, think about this. How do you stand up in front of people and do the opposite? Or to say it otherwise, the leaders of the Episcopal Church USA, why are they in it? What are they doing?
Is it that they have this prayer book with this beautiful language and they get to wear fancy robes and trot about? I don't know. I can't imagine why one would be in the church if one didn't believe the beliefs of the church, the beliefs of the Bible. It makes no sense to me whatsoever.
Well, I think there must be some level of guilt thinking in this, some cognitive dissonance, as a psychologist would put it, because they are intent on changing the language of the church. And so here's the transition as I note it, and you track and see if this is true from your experience watching the Episcopal Church in North America, especially the Episcopal Church USA. What happens is you start out with people who believe it. They read it and believe it and they teach it. Then they read it and subvert it. And then they change the wording. But it's in that middle period that the people in the pew generally don't see what's happening.
I think that's probably right, yeah.
I think that's why so many people in the pew, the laypersons in these denominations, are unaware when the faith is being sold out by those who are supposed to be their faithful shepherds, the ones who are assigned the task of teaching and preaching and leading them.
During that middle period, the ministers are oftentimes evading the creed rather than outright denying it.
Spell that out just a little bit. That's a great point.
Well, saying the creed, but with your fingers crossed, you know, redefining the language to mean something that it never meant historically. So it looks like you're asserting the meaning of the creed, but you're not, because you don't believe any bit of it by redefinition. Way too common.
Let me read to you here from page 35 of Cranmer's first English prayer book, this, again, 1549, soon to be 500 years old. Because thou didst give Jesus Christ, thine only Son, to be born at this day for us, this is Christmas, by the way, this is a communion prayer, who by the operation of the Holy Ghost was made very man, of the substance of the Virgin Mary, his mother, and that without spot of sin, to make us clean from all sin. Therefore, with the angels, we say. You know, it just couldn't be any more clear about that.
No, it's crystal clear.
And so what you have at some point, and that's that middle period I'm talking about, are persons who read these words, and you say they do it with their fingers crossed. That's a great way to express it. But, you know, the most amazing thing is when they read this, it has to feel like treason not to believe it. I just don't understand this. I guess I'm back with the Apostle Paul wondering why these false prophets, these super preachers, as he identifies them in the Corinthian correspondence, would appear to lead persons astray. But if nothing else, perhaps those listening to the program today will learn from this the necessity of paying attention not only to what is said, but to what is meant.
Absolutely. Yes. And it's not enough to be moved by the language being evocative. You need to know what the language means.
Yes, and that means asking some questions, such as when someone sings a hymn about the virgin birth, they actually believe
right. That
Jesus Christ was conceived in the Virgin Mary by the Holy Ghost. You know, I was just preaching, as a matter of fact, through the different lines and statements of the Apostles' Creed. And I know that creed is read in almost every liberal church on Sunday. And I just don't know how you could possibly say those things when line by line, the fact is, if you don't believe in the statement that he was conceived of the Holy Ghost, you know, you actually don't believe in any of those other things either, except by force of will.
Right. No, that's true.
What we're looking at here is a comprehensive collapse of biblical Christianity. And so we can be left with great despair. And if we just left the conversation at this point, a lot of people just think, well, we should move to Africa and join African churches. But there are signs of hope here. And as a matter of fact, I wouldn't be here in Charleston if there were not very substantial signs of hope on the ground right here. So let me just ask the Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon, rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church in Fort Worth, Texas, what gives you hope for this challenge and through this conference for your church?
There has never been a better time to be an Anglican than now. Maybe the 16th century, but this is an exciting time, because the seeds that were planted by English Christianity many years ago have grown deep roots. They've grown a beautiful fruit, and we're enjoying that fruit now, and they're speaking to us. They're ministering to us. So we're getting reintegrated with the faith that we once took to them. It's beautiful.
Now, one of the things I want to say is I'm here, and I'll be expressing this tonight as a word of indebtedness, because here I am, a Southern Baptist, meeting with an Anglican minister in this conversation. And, you know, so many of my good friends are in various churches, especially Presbyterians, Methodists, and all the rest. You can use these words without tracing the history, knowing we share a common root. And English-speaking Christianity, as especially defined by the Reformation of the 16th century, is the garden from which so many churches and denominations have grown, including the Southern Baptists, who, as part of the Baptist movement, emerged out of British separatism in the next century, in the 17th century. And there's just so much to be thankful for as we look to this. And I have to say, I'm extremely moved and encouraged to be here in the presence of so many who are fighting a good fight, and doing so, I must say, with good cheer. Because after all, this is not our church, whatever its label. If it's a true church, it's Christ's church. And he will reign forever and ever. Back with final thoughts. I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Today's broadcast live from Charleston, South Carolina, one of my favorite cities to visit. It's a city that just is saturated with history. What can you say about a city that's main streets are streets like Meeting Street, King Street, Queen Street, Bay Street? You look out and see Fort Sumter. You realize all that went on here. You're looking at a church like St. Michael's Church here that had to have its tower blackened during the Revolutionary War because the British were using it as a sighting tool for bombardment of the city. This is the city where the first Baptist church in the South was established, here, the First Baptist Church of Charleston. And I had the great honor of preaching its 350th anniversary just recently. And it's also a city that is just filled with Episcopal churches, with Anglican influence, because this city, named for Charles II of England, is one of the most English places on the planet. Sometimes I feel more English than some English towns I've had the opportunity to visit. But as much as we are here looking at the past, and to be in Charleston is to be reminded of the past, you have preservation plaques on, it seems, every other house, especially down here in the historic district. As much as we are focused here on the past, we're also focused on the future. This Mere Anglicanism Conference, which I've been invited to speak and in which I'm honored to participate, is looking not just to the past but to the future. My guest today has been the Reverend Dr. Bill Dixon, rector of St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, Fort Worth, Texas. Just in closing minutes here, I want to ask Dr. Dixon, when you think about your church and you think about your denomination, you have to have a sense of almost trembling at the historical consequence of what could be happening just this year and in the next several years.
Yes, I think what's going on now will have huge implications for the future. So what we're doing at our church in Fort Worth reaches beyond Fort Worth. So we're part of a global movement here, and it's very exciting. Very exciting time to be an Anglican.
It's an exciting time for any Christian, I think, to see the issues defined in terms of the gospel, because too many times it's defined in terms of church politics, in terms of cultural controversies, but we're now at the point where the essence of the thing is now before us. We're arguing over the very nature of the gospel, the identity of the church, what we believe about Jesus Christ. That's, of course, what joins all true Christians together. One Lord and one faith and one baptism as we're thinking about these things. But that's also why we share a common concern when we see that faith abdicated. Absolutely. When we see it denied and subverted. So I just have to tell you, as I'm seeing my listening audience here, I'm finding great encouragement from being here, and it's just a reminder that our neighborhood in the church is just that. It is a neighborhood. No one of us can be everywhere in all times to see what God is doing, but God is doing something in this generation that is just as faithful and powerful as he has done in generations past, and he points us towards a future in which he will perfect that which he has begun. That's why I stay in this task and calling, and that's why I know my guest does as well. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation, another live broadcast from Charleston, South Carolina. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.